Welcome to the Future of Political Consulting by the AAPC, where we explore the evolving landscape of political consulting in a rapidly changing world. The AAPC is a bipartisan membership organization that represents professionals working in the political consulting industry. Our hosts today are the co-chairs of AAPC's New York Metro chapter, Bradley Honan and Chapin Fay. Bradley is a Democratic pollster and data analyst, and Chapin is a seasoned Republican communications strategist. They will be leading the discussion with Patrick Graffini, renowned GOP pollster and author of Party of the People, Inside the Multiracial Populist Coalition Remaking the GOP. Together, they will help listeners to understand the dynamics of contemporary politics and the future of partisan coalitions. Bradley and Chapin, take it away.
Thanks very much, Kelly, and thank you, Patrick, for joining Chapin and I today. We appreciate your time and are super excited for the conversation today. What I wanted to do, Patrick, in getting started is maybe you can just level set for us. There has been a lot of discussion. You're a renowned scholar and analyst of the working class, the populist coalition. Can you level set for us, Patrick, and help us put a fine point on defining what does it mean to be working class? When you talk about a populist coalition, what definition are you referring to?
Yeah, I mean, I really do think it is a populist coalition built primarily around college education and or lack of college education. That seems to have been the fundamental dividing line in the shifts we have seen over the last three presidential election cycles, where it first started out in 2016 with a shift right among white non-college voters. And that was just a very, very clean way of looking at that shift because, you know, you just look at the places with lots of non-college white voters. Those are the places that shifted, particularly in the upper Midwest in 2016. And then you do have a shift right among Latino voters and in 2020, and that has continued into 2024, but broadened out. And those tend to be very working class communities in the sense of not having a college degree. Income, right? You would think income is one way of defining the working class. It just tends to be less, it tends to have less explanatory power in kind of figuring out what the shifts have been. You know, obviously income can vary quite a bit based on region. And, you know, when we are talking about are really the different mindsets that voters have, that really does seem to be defined by whether you went to college and had a college degree and completed your college education or whether you didn't. Obviously, that's a pretty crude way of looking at it. Others might have a different definition, but statistically, it really hasn't failed in terms of the, you know, its explanatory power in looking at these shifts that we've seen over the last few election cycles.
And I think you have been at the forefront of this trend for a number of cycles, but the recent analysis that the New York Times did using a couple of different data sources showed that whites with no college degree moved Republican by 13 points, non-whites with a BA or more moved 21 points, non-whites no degree, 37-point swing to the Republicans. That's a dramatic shift, Patrick.
Yeah, and obviously non-whites with a college degree also moved, right? So it's not necessarily as pure as I, you know, I'm pointing it out to be, because and in my book, what I really you know, when I talk about the multiracial populist coalition, it really is non-whites plus whites without a college degree. And then you have the whites with a college degree who really seem to be off on an island of their own, right, in terms of things. And why is that? You know, what we've really seen over the last, you know, over the last generation, two generations, is really strong ideological polarization among white voters, where, you know, if you define yourself as a white liberal, you know, you're voting Democrat 95% or more. If you define yourself as a white conservative, same thing for the Republicans. But, you know, you just have a much more muddled picture, you know, when you look at, you know, what are the views of non-white voters on policy, and they're quite often more conservative than their voting patterns are. And that is true regardless of education, that when you see, you know, a group like white college educated liberals or white, the white college voter in many ways you know, just comes in a lot more liberal on virtually every issue than a non-white voter would come in. And so you have, you know, again, you know, in this kind of segment of the electorate, which I call, you know, kind of the multiracial working class, multiracial populist coalition, is about 70% of the electorate, that it's just historically not been as ideologically polarized around issues, which has created this space, right, for things to shift from election cycle to election cycle pretty dramatically. Back in 2012 and 2008, we were talking about a shift to the left among these voters because, you know, Democrats really did seem to have the initiative, the advantage, particularly among the non-white electorate. But as, over since then, right, it has been a shift right, and, you know, especially among non-white voters. And again, that it's not entirely based on, right, the college, non-college thing, but, you know, particularly in non-white communities that have historically voted very Democratic, they are just much more ideologically diverse and mixed than that voting track record. And so I think people are kind of converging towards that ideological view of politics, which we've certainly seen, you know, take hold in, you know, in large segments of the electorate, but not as much among non-white voters up until now.
And you had an interesting post as it relates to income, because this is obviously college educated, non-college educated is something you've talked and written about, but you wrote something where you said the income gap has become fully inverted, not just among whites. Donald Trump is the first Republican in decades to win more support from the lowest income group than the higher income groups. And I think you linked to excise some data from the Financial Times saying Democrats fared better with the richest Americans than the poorest for the first time in decades. So there's an income phenomenon to this, Patrick, which of course is somewhat correlated and causation with college education or the lack of it.
That's right. And, you know, you look at how the Democratic Party and how the Republican Party was really, really defined when I first came into politics and first came into professional politics around the year 2000. And even then, you just had a very strong definition in association of the Democratic Party as the party of the working man. I call my book Party of the People. And, you know, the Democrats had been called the party of the people. And it's no accident that has begun to that flip, right, potentially, where Republicans could now be the party of the people. And, you know, historically, the Democratic Party, it's not just a late 20th century phenomenon, but going back to the 19th century, going back to the very founding of the Democratic Party, it was always seen as the party of the outsider, you know, in terms of, you know, the agricultural interests back in the 19th century and the urban working classes during the industrial era and the New Deal and the Great Society. This was really central to the identity of the Democratic Party. And what we've seen post 2000, it's not just a post 2016 phenomenon, is gradually that identity of the Democratic Party they've shed that identity more and more in favor of, you know, egalitarianism as it relates to race and gender, right? I mean, that seems to have been the defining issue. If you look at the American National Election Studies, the strongest positive association, right, up until 2004 with the Democrats was that they were the party of the common man. They were the party of the worker. You know, that was something. And then after that, it's a flip to the point where they are now associated as the party of, you know, quote unquote, marginalized groups, and marginalized groups that, you know, often defined in terms of race, often defined in terms of race, gender. But the irony here is they have lost those voters really because in many ways they've lost that identity as that working man's party. And that was the shift I was really trying to capture really at the outset of my book. You know, I was really talking about that heritage of the two political parties. Conversely, the Republicans, right, did not have the best image. They were always viewed as kind of the party of the rich, the party of, and that was something that Democrats used to great effect. And, you know, you hear less and less of that these days.
Chapin, I know, has done work, and I know you've alluded to this in your book, Patrick, for Lee Zeldin, who ran in 2022, kind of a precursor campaign, a very populist economic populism around inflation, around crime. Chapin, you've had experience working in Republican circles where candidates are often more populist, as Patrick is saying, than that classic country club image that many of us think about our sort of our father's Republican Party, if you will.
Yeah, and I would just say, you know, here in New York City, it even sort of precedes that. And, you know, we've been making incremental gains just sort of along the lines that Patrick is talking about with particularly some of these demographic groups. And I guess my question, Patrick, you know, we here in New York always say, you know, how New York goes, so there goes the nation, right? But is that what you're seeing, you know, across the rest of the country in different states and cities, you know, in places that are traditionally very blue? You know, you have this creeping, even in the most liberal or blue areas like Manhattan, you have this creeping rightward shift, as you both have mentioned. Is this happening all over the place? You know, in New York, it's been, you know, sort of years and cycles in the making. And now, you know, for example, the Republican Minority Caucus on the city council is larger, and it's in places like the Bronx, you know, with a lot of Hispanics, and in Brooklyn with Eastern Europeans and Jewish voters. So is that sort of a good microcosm of what's happening around the rest of the country, or is it happening a little differently in your view?
No, I think that really summarizes it pretty well, because New York City obviously moved significantly to the right. Now, I think Trump was over 30% of the vote in New York City. And the reason why I love looking at New York City is just, you know, you don't just have a Latino population, you have everyone, and you have all the different subgroups, and you can really drill down on very specific subgroups within the electorate that, you know, encapsulate really the full spectrum of, you know, you have Asian voters in Queens, you've got Eastern European and Jewish voters in Brooklyn, Asians in Brooklyn, right? I mean, all of these different groups, you know, you really see kind of the very clear differences neighborhood to neighborhood. But, you know, in particular, right, you had two major shifts, right? You had a shift right in 2020, but I think a more comprehensive, fuller shift right in 2024, where this trend, this phenomenon, I think really wasn't really on people's radar heading into the 2020 election. I mean, there were some rough signs of it in polling, but frankly, like when we're looking at 2020, the story there was COVID. The story there was, okay, Trump is polling, you know, behind. Can he catch up? Right. We think he might overperform, because obviously the polls don't seem to capture the Trump phenomenon really well. But and there was never really a talk about this phenomenon. I think after 4 years of both there being, I think, a lot of talk about, you know, the successes that Trump had in shifting a lot of these working class communities, as well as I think Trump being more conscious of it himself and campaigning, particularly to young men, using podcasts, really aiming for this electorate in a way that it really hadn't in 2016 and 2020, even created this surge that we actually saw in places like New York City.
Patrick, I want to reference something you wrote and ask you about it. You talked about lessons from the revolt, feeling the anger. And what you had written here was what Tuesday showed us is that Republicans can win victories in unlikely places, rising independent frustration with Washington's failure to change as promised. And then talking about the candidate, a direct down-to-earth style is a larger point. It's not enough to talk against the establishment. You somehow have to embody what the establishment is not. You wrote that, of course, back in 2010 about the Scott Brown victory in Massachusetts, but that analysis could well have been delivered only a couple of weeks ago. And my question is, somebody who has really had their finger on the pulse of this has been a brewing trend, if you will. Obviously, you referenced 2016 and 2020 and 2024 of the contours of that coming together. But there is a malaise, to quote President Carter, that exists right now among the populace and has for a long time. And I guess I wanted you to talk maybe longitudinally about some of the changes that you see in our economic cycle, the social life of the country. We are today where we are expecting a second Trump presidency because a lot of the factors that drove us here. Can you give us your longitudinal view going back to that election or further back in terms of why we are where we are today?
Wow. I just want to commend you for digging that far back into the archives and reading back to me something I honestly didn't remember I had written, but seems to be apt in terms of the current moment that we're in.
Quite prescient, right? Yes.
So I think, in 2010, you had the Tea Party revolt within the Republican Party. I mean, it was really, a moment of awakening where the party did become more populist, right, in its style post-2008 in the initial response to the financial crisis and the Obama presidency. But it was still a little bit fits and starts at that time in terms of the party's underlying core identity. Because, even at the time you had that movement was very much associated with outwardly in Washington, D.C., with kind of this idea of fiscal conservatism and against spending and against big government. And you really had a number of groups in Washington in the conservative movement who were really trying to make that time in our politics really about that. And then, what you have in 2012, though, is not necessarily a populist and by any means Republican nominee, but Mitt Romney, but somebody who very much embodies that more economically focused Republican and, going in with a pro-business, economic, can-do managerial message, but that ultimately falls short, right? Because stylistically, he is not kind of the pitchfork guy storming the gates of the castle. And, fundamentally, that was not what voters were really looking for. The economic, the particular brand of economic messaging, even though his image on the economy was pretty strong, the sort of ideological message that I think Republicans at that time were putting forward was not really something voters were asking for. Into the breach steps Donald Trump, right? And, he is somebody who, really understands the most of this energy and most of this discontent in the post-Bush era. It was something I experienced directly working for President Bush in 2004 and in the RNC in the aftermath of the 2004 election. The base was really angry about immigration. Really, that was the issue for a lot of folks in the base. You had layered onto that the perception that, President Bush had sold out the base with the bank bailout and just all of these examples kind of piling up in the second term. And I think really only Trump addressed the root causes of it, which again was not this sort of anti-government libertarian ideological movement that you had in 2010, but it was more of a broadly speaking against the anti-system candidate, somebody who just didn't think Washington worked. And I think Democrats took the bait, right, in opposing Trump on those grounds. That's when you really started to see the economic populism drain out of the party as they're confronting this new threat, which is more populist, which, they think they can attack Trump on, say controversial things about immigrants, about minority groups, and really making their party first about identity, right? Trying to activate these minority voters against Trump on the basis of the fact that he's a racist, he's a xenophobe, he's intolerant. And then I think eventually pivoting to this idea that he is sort of beyond the pale as a character, right? As somebody you don't want in charge of the nuclear weapons, you don't want in charge of the government. Really pivoting, leaning into this institute of both identity and institutions, right? More this pro-institution message. Lo and behold, I think the image of their party, right, becomes in this time period just so much more associated with, we are the ones who, in defending kind of the institutions of democracy. What as swing voters, I think, are often hearing is this is the pro-system party, right? These are the people who think kind of democracy and things as they are kind of work just fine. Whereas if you have somebody like Trump, who, again, is with the barbarians at the gate trying to agitate against the system, I think that is temperamentally where a lot of people are. And it's not just those Republican primary voters, right, who delivered him that surprise victory in 2016, but it's really voters in the middle who don't like Washington, don't like the system, don't like institutions. And so it has been a mistake, I think, for the Democrats to, really realign themselves, right, in that vein.
I do want to follow up on two things. Sort of first, the Trump factor, so to speak. What is your sense of, is this Trump's Republican Party and they sort of followed him where he was going? Or is he a symptom of sort of today's or a reflection of today's Republican Party? How much is this just sheer force of, you know, the incoming president's will?
Right. I mean, I think you put your finger on something, which is the leader, the nominee doesn't always reflect the zeitgeist among the voters. It's usually what happens is it was simply the best option available, right, at the time when the primaries were being held. And so, that's why you get the Republican nominees we had before Trump, because, you know, it is a choice among imperfect options. And, you know, I think as somebody who tapped into the zeitgeist that was building after 2008, especially around the issue of immigration, but the populist wave, the sort of broadly anti-establishmentarian wave that you're seeing within the party, and the deep seething, I think, frustration that Republican primary voters had with their leaders, right? You know, I think that they have, Republican primary voters have a relationship, a very strained relationship with most of their elected officials that Democrats don't have. And that created an opening, you know, for somebody to emerge, right, who was positioned in the most radical way against that type of leadership. And, you know, and certainly in many ways, I think he is a creature of that. You know, I think he is a creature of somebody who, you know, was not a Republican to begin with, right? Be clear on that, but really tapped into the zeitgeist of Fox News, of talk radio, of really all of these populist undercurrents within the party, really kind of feeling that out throughout the 2010s and that post-Tea Party era. And so I think in many ways, he's more of a creature of it, but he's an expression of it. I think, he's an expression of it that's, you know, obviously the celebrity factor. He is somebody who can take it further, right? Then you've had other candidates who've tried and failed to capture this movement, and they could never quite pull it off. You have a lot of MAGA candidates down ballot who think they can capture Trump's personality or imitate Trump's personality, and it doesn't work. But I do think, right, in many ways, right, you know, he is very plugged in to what the base is saying. He does his best to really well and truly represent those people at the highest levels of government in a way that no other Republican did before them. And as a result, I think the base trusts him implicitly to deliver for them, even when, you know, he is making compromises, which I think is a superpower that he has that no other Republican does. And I think as a result, he has a lot more flexibility in terms of how he implements and how he's going to implement his agenda, because he has this running room from the base that, you know, I think in many ways, a previous generation of Republican would be really struggling to appease, you know, certain elements of the party constantly, you know, and it would be something that would be very fraught. I think right now, you know, I think he's well positioned to move the party, obviously in his direction, but to get things done, because I don't think he has those constraints that, you know, a previous style and generation of Republicans had.
Patrick, let me ask you, from the Democratic side, there's a lot of sense that this was a very unique election for a number of reasons. Biden's ratings were very weak, as you know. Harris had a finite period of 100 and something days to run a race against Trump. And all around the world, we've seen incumbent parties voted out of office. Trump will not ever be on the ballot again. And how much of this do you see as a phenomenon specific to Donald Trump? In other words, you've used the big R word, realignment. Is this now something that you see as a durable co-option of the Democratic coalition going forward? Or if the GOP goes with a more traditional nominee going forward, somebody like a Mitt Romney or out of that playbook, do you see this being a new swing group, if you will, in American politics going forward? How durable is this GOP working class coalition?
I think it's pretty durable, but maybe not in the sense you're thinking about, in the sense of, you know, when we talk about realignment, there's a type of realignment where you talk about it from the perspective of one party is sort of dominant over a generation or over, at least a period of a few election cycles. And I really go out of my way to not try and make that claim or not try even make that prediction, right? Because, I mean, I think anytime any book previously to this has tried to say that, it's always the next election. It's like a curse, right? The party loses the remainder. It's on the remainder bin. Fast track to the remainder bin. But I do think that in terms of the changing nature of the internal nature of the coalition, I think it's a pretty damn durable change, because you're seeing it all around the world. You see it in other countries, in the rise of more populist right-wing parties in Western Europe, that the entire sort of architecture of conservative right-wing politics in a lot of places is more and more driven, you know, along this class realignment, where, you know, it's just increasingly based within the working classes, is increasingly based in the politics of, you know, people who are lower income, more working class, whatnot. So I think from that perspective, the, you know, if you're looking at the Republican primary election in 2028 and moving forward, it's just a different electorate than what we would have had in 2012, what we would have had in 2008, just fundamentally, and what it takes to win. In the same way, I think Ronald Reagan was a change agent in the same way, right? That prior to Ronald Reagan, it was very hard for, let's say, a conservative ideologue to win in a Republican primary. And then after Ronald Reagan, right, that becomes possible. And even if you have people like Gerry Ford, Gerry Ford was the kind of like the last transitional figure, but George H.W. Bush, and then subsequently McCain, Mitt Romney, somebody who, you know, they are perceived more in the center, they always have to pitch themselves to a certain way as conservatives to win a Republican primary. That didn't really happen before 1980, but it happened in every election since 1980. So I think in that sense, there is a realignment. I think it's more cultural realignment. It's not necessarily like that was an ideological realignment. But I think, you know, if you're saying like, oh, is the Republican Party going to simply go back to nominating the same kind of candidates that, you know, you had before Trump? I just don't think that's possible, given the shape of the Republican primary electorate.
Let me take one question that's come in through the chat, and Chapin, then I'll give you the last word and the last questions here. Patrick, the question from one of our AAPC members is, are there specific policy areas that have been most instrumental in reshaping these voter coalitions, particularly among non-white voters? And are there key issues that either party can adopt going forward that will allow it to speak to that group most persuasively?
Well, I think there are issues, right, that Trump adopted in, particularly in 2016, and, you know, even in this time around trade and immigration are the two issues that I think he foregrounded over the course of his campaigns that really did send the message at first to voters in the industrial Midwest that he really was different in terms of the other Republicans who had run before, that in terms of whereas, you know, previous iterations of Republicans were running on basically an unadulterated tax cuts and pro-economic liberty message that did not really connect with working class voters. Trump aimed very squarely, even early in his 2016 campaign, in the Midwest, at this idea of trade, America losing its competitive advantage compared to other countries, that really did send the message to people, to those voters, right? The intended message. And it wasn't just, again, Republican primary voters. It was swing voters, the voters who had the classic Obama to Trump voter, I think resonated with that. Now, in 2024, it's a little bit more unexpected in terms of immigration. I think it's back on the menu in terms of like a driving issue, but it's back in a way that unifies all the members of this coalition, including Latinos, all right, including groups that were thought to be, this was the issue you didn't want to talk about if you're a Republican. And because it was framed in a way that you have, you know, people who are coming into the country who are not like the people who are already in the country, who are coming in, taking government benefits, should not really be here. And if you're talking about an electorate, a Latino electorate especially, that is, number one, a voting electorate and therefore a citizen electorate. That is just, it's very hard to you know, paint any sense of shared group interest, right, between folks just crossing the border now and folks who came here two or three generations ago, obviously legally, into the country. And so that was an issue, right? That was a very clear, I think, dividing line for all members of this coalition. And I think this is a fundamental change in the way, right, the Democrats viewed the issue as this was going to be the new civil rights. This was going to be an issue that, you know, really galvanized Latinos and solidified them as a Democratic group against Trump. And it really hasn't worked. But I also just think, in general, though, as well, cultural issues have really redefined the playing field here, whereas I think that a lot of the economic questions, right, Democrats haven't litigated them as much over the course of the last few election cycles. And as a result, what has filled the void, right? What's filled the void is these culture war issues where non-white voters are furthest apart from the Democratic Party in their views. And that just takes a toll, right? That eventually sinks in enough to where you start to get these shifts.
Two final questions. First on strategy, the second a little bit more tactical. But so how do you see the upcoming midterms? Is it going to be sort of as history as a guy where it's going to be, you know, a correction on President Trump and the Republicans? And I guess my question really is, what do Trump and the Republicans need to do to keep this coalition together and perhaps minimize losses? And what do the Democrats have to do to sort of win some of these folks back and maybe try and retake the House or Senate in the midterms?
Well, I mean, I feel like, you know, if we're talking about congressional elections, we're in a period of trench warfare, right? I mean, where it's only a few seats that are going to flip, change hands. I mean, we've seen that over the last couple election cycles, and especially post-redistricting, which have really narrowed the playing field pretty dramatically in terms of at least in the House. And, you know, we are seeing an ongoing realignment, obviously, in the Senate, where, you know, all of the red states are... You know, the red states have a natural majority in the United States Senate, but it really hasn't expressed itself because of candidate quality issues the Republicans have had over the last few election cycles. But that Republicans are gradually kind of chipping away at that advantage that Democrats have had in terms of candidate recruitment and incumbency. So I think fundamentally, I mean, I think the base case for 26, right, is just continued trench warfare in the House. I think the challenge, though, and we saw this, I think, this time around, too, the challenge for Republicans has been they've not been able to, I think, capitalize on this in the House, in the House battlegrounds, as well as Trump did in the presidential battlegrounds. And that's the shape of the map. And when the unit sort of warfare is the congressional district as opposed to the state, that does seem to change the playing field. And particularly with the Republicans making these gains in urban areas, and also running up the score in rural areas, we're starting to see the opposite problem, the problem Democrats had before, where you had so many more wasted votes in cities. Now Republicans have more wasted votes in rural areas, which makes the actual battleground districts lean a little bit further left, you know, in a way, in the congressional playing field. But again, like, it's a, you know, whether or not, like, Democrats retake control of Congress, if they do, it's not going to be a wave because just the amount of safe seats that they have. But I do think Republicans need to figure this out, right? They need to, I think, in many ways, get close enough or figure out how to draw districts. Like a district like New Jersey 9, right, which is unexpectedly close this time around, swung right, but was still not a win in the congressional race there, which united kind of working class Latinos and working class white voters in northern New Jersey. I mean, it's those types of districts that Republicans really haven't thought about before, and whether or not also. That if you Republicans in Texas or somewhere else are going to try to go back for another bite at the apple, knowing that, hey, it seems like our incumbents are pretty safe. Maybe we don't need to do as much incumbent protection, and we need to do these mid-cycle redistrictings that are, in the end, probably going to affect the playing field in the House at least more than, you know, than any massive shift that you're seeing at the national level.
Yeah, and then just sort of in that vein on the trench warfare, are there any tactics you're seeing that are working particularly well when it comes to sort of slicing and dicing these different demographics who may be shifted right, you know, whether you're talking to Hispanic men or Black men? Are there different tactics within those groups that are working? Or, you know, how are these folks or voters getting their information and making their decisions? Do you have any insight onto this? Is it all of the above, or is mail still working? Is it text messaging and digital these days? What sort of is the best way to reach these ethnically diverse voters?
Yeah, I mean, it's an all of the above strategy. And I think Trump was extremely well suited to, you know, take his megaphone into those communities by, you know, really doing things that were very culturally relevant within those communities, whether it was going to UFC matches, whether it was going on podcasts that he went on. Now, that's obviously very specific. There are certain things only a presidential candidate can do. But when you're talking about a fragmented media environment, this is not an electorate that is going to be reached very well by linear television, and particularly this persuadable voters. And the persuadable voters in this campaign, and I think we can say in a lot of campaigns, right, moving forward, are these younger voters who are kind of have the three-way option. They're either going to go for a Republican, they're going to go for the Democrat, or they're not going to vote. And there's many realms in which they are, you know, potentially undecided. And so, you know, they, as a result, much more up for grabs. Both more persuadable, but also may not turn out as much. And so those are the voters who, those are exactly the voters who are not watching linear television. And so, you know, but maybe engaged in these more non-political podcasts and whatnot in those types of, that type of media too. One thing I saw today that was really interesting, a Nate Cohn piece in the New York Times, where, you know, he was looking at some of the voter file data about who voted and who didn't. And yeah, you know, in African Americans in Georgia, actually Harris did really well among the people who voted. I mean, it was like an 87-8 split in terms of New York Times polls among the Georgians, Black Georgians who voted. But I think that the Black Georgians who didn't vote were something like only like 55-35 for Harris, which is a stunning difference from where the Black community has been historically. But those voters didn't vote, which means that I think Trump left some games on the table, right? that I do think that Republicans, campaigns especially, still need to adapt to this new reality of how do you actually go in directly into these communities, knock on their door with people who are from those communities and identify, you know, who those non-voters are and bring them out.
Patrick Ruffini, you are reminding us why you are such a shrewd political analyst, founding partner of Echelon Insights, a Republican polling firm, and author of Party of the People: Inside the Multiracial Populist Coalition Remaking the GOP, what the New York Times called the book that predicted the 2024 election. Thank you so much for taking the time to visit with Chapin and I and our membership. Thank you, Patrick.
Thanks. I enjoyed it a lot.
Thank you, Patrick. Good seeing you.
That was our chat with Bradley Honan, Chapin Fay, and Patrick Ruffini. Special thanks to the AAPC New York Metro chapter for sponsoring this program. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to The Future of Political Consulting by the AAPC on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And join the conversation by following us on social media at the AAPC. Thanks for listening.